Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And this is the aforementioned Eagle One, otherwise known as Mark. Sal has managed somehow to disconnect himself from the system, so let me do the introduction today. Our guest today is Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg. He's an expert on security issues in the former Soviet Union, Russian military reform, Russian foreign policy, and ethnic politics and identity, and he's done a bunch of research on decision-making processes in the senior Russian leadership, Russian Naval Strategy in the Pacific, Black Sea, Russian Maritime Defense Doctrine. He's the author of Nationalism for the Masses, Minority Ethnic Mobilization in Russian Federation, and a whole bunch of other stuff you can find online if you search for Dmitry Gorenberg. He currently works at CNA and also serves as an editor of Problems of Post-Communism and is an associate at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. And he previously served as director for the Association of Slavic East European and Eurasian Studies. He received his BA in International Relations from Princeton University. Yay, Princeton! And PhD in Political Science from Harvard University. He blogs on issues related to Russian military reform. He is a native Russian speaker. So with that being said, and Sal seems to be back online, welcome to Midrats, Dr. Gorenberg. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, sorry about that. Literally about 30 seconds before the show went, my line went dead. So I'm calling in on my phone because my switchboard is getting goofy, but that's okay. I think it'll flow along just fine anyway. But Dmitry, thank you again very much for coming on. And I wanted to kick things off today because it's sometimes you can have trouble in a daily scan getting news of substance from Russia that's outside the, you know, very American-focused news that everybody is used to seeing. But everything derives from power and government, and there recently was a big shakeup in the new year of the Russian government. Of course, President Putin is still there, but another name that most people would recognize, Dmitry Medvedev, he's out as prime minister. The Sergei brothers for the foreign policy people, Sergei Lavrov and Sergei Shoigu, who's the defense minister, are still in. But if you could give us an overview of the important things that people should keep in mind with the latest shakeup as we know it in the Russian government.
Well, Sal, I think that the main thing to keep in mind is that Russia is Putin regime is slowly approaching a critical year, which is 2024, which is when Vladimir Putin's, fourth term as president, but second in the current iteration, ends. And according to the Russian Constitution, as it currently stands, president cannot serve more than two consecutive terms. So this, I think the shakeup in January that you mentioned was sort of step one of a process of transition where they are working on how to how the regime will look after 2024. So you mentioned the government shakeup. There are also some proposed constitutional changes that were announced at the same time. And that, I think, is where a lot of the initial steps are being kind of seeded. My sense, and a lot of this is kind of, for us Kremlin watchers, it's a little bit of guesswork as to where they're going to go with it. But my guess is that they don't have a firm decision on how things will look after 2024. We suspect that Putin is not going to you know, retire to a dacha somewhere. But most likely he also will no longer be president. So what that means is, how do you manage a transition where Putin can keep control of the country and the leadership while moving to some kind of new position? And there are one possibility that I think is reasonably likely is a sort of a senior sort of president emeritus sort of position. What they call it, I don't know, but it's kind of like Deng Xiaoping had in China in his later years, or what Nazarbayev now has in Kazakhstan, where they're no longer the president, they no longer have the formal number one position, but they're still effectively in charge of the country. And so the question is how to manage that while also ensuring that, let's say, the formal number, whoever the formal number one is, the actual president and so forth, doesn't betray the senior leader, as it were. So I think that is where a lot of the shaping is happening now. And part of to get back to the government shakeup itself, Medvedev has been blamed by a lot of the population for the relatively anemic economic growth of the recent years and general kind of ineffectiveness. Part of the problem with when Medvedev and Putin switched roles back in 2012, and Medvedev became prime minister and Putin became president again, was that this was really Putin essentially kind of emasculated Medvedev, and that he was really shown to have no independent power whatsoever, and so. The problem with that for Medvedev is that he sort of became, while he was running the government, he also became kind of a laughingstock for the population. And so, but Putin remained, had promised him the prime ministership and is famously loyal to people who are loyal to him. So he kept him on until this point, and I think that the fact that he's now been moved to effectively a kind of a semi-retired role suggests that this is the beginning of kind of a discussion within the elite of who will follow, who will have some of those senior positions in the formal structure after 2024.
Well, are there, just to follow along on that, are there people that we should be keeping an eye on in the Russian hierarchy as it exists now that are kind of favored candidates, or is that something not allowed under the Putin way of doing things?
The people who are the people who show who pop their heads up too early tend to get them chopped off. You know what I mean? I think that the most likely. I can give you some names that, are potential successors, but the most likely is none of the above, because I think, much like Putin appeared out of nowhere in 1999, right, as far as anyone who was watching, who the most influential people in the Kremlin were, in the late Yeltsin period, I think something very similar is most likely going to happen here, and the person that's going to end up running things is probably not someone that we're keeping an eye on at the moment. There are some younger people who are seen as fairly loyal and I wouldn't say unambitious, but maybe not looking, let's say, unambitious in the sense that they're not looking to take Putin out. So somebody like Anton Vigno, who is the at the head of the presidential administration, is fairly influential. He, you know, there is a question of in the modern Russia, can somebody who is ethnically, you know, sort of not totally Russian, he's of Estonian descent, would that be acceptable? You know, much the same has been said about some Sergei Shoigu, who is a defense minister and is of Tuvan descent, so a Siberian nationality. So it's also been mentioned in the past as a potential successor, although at this point he's not that much younger than Putin. You know, I could probably come up with a couple other names, but I, you know, there's this new prime minister who's most likely a caretaker figure, but you never know. If he turns out to be really successful, he could make a name for himself. It's Mishustin, who comes from, he was heading the tax police before he became prime minister.
Yeah, it's great, I guess, because I remember the first time many moons ago that we had you on Midrat. I think we started off saying that, well, nobody else seems to be interested in Russia, but we still are. And it was nice that the rest of the world is caught up with us. Yeah. And to hear phrases like criminology and Kremlin watchers come back, it reminds me that part of the challenge, I think, for perhaps Americans especially, but Westerners in general, in trying to understand Russia is, you know, Russia's not an European power. It's a Eurasian power. They're not really Western, though when you look at Western cultural issues, music, dance, everything else, that the Russians have such a huge presence there. They're definitely not Eastern. They have their own unique kind of Russian way of looking at things, history, cultural norms. It's not Western, not Eastern. And in many ways, that's kind of how the Russians see themselves as well. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, I don't like to get too into these kind of cultural explanations for difference, right? I think, you know, you could easily say, well, you know, the French are different from the British or the Poles or the Spanish, right? So, I don't know. I think it's more, rather than talking about culture, I would maybe talk about the legacies of the way Russia developed and the Soviet Union developed over, you know, a long time period. So it's kind of a not culture so much as kind of institutional legacies, as it were, right? The fact that Russia was a communist state with you know, without private property and those kinds of things for 70 years had an impact on how it developed. Certainly the geography does have an impact in that it's just such a large country and the bulk of it fairly sparsely populated, and that has certain implications for control and how the leadership thinks that you really need a strong center to keep it all together. Otherwise, you know, distant parts that are, you know, 10 or whatever time zones away will just wander off by themselves. So I think that I would more focus it on those kinds of structural institutional factors rather than differences in culture, which to my mind often the differences that we see often follow from the structure rather than the other way around.
That raises I'm kind of see if I can approach this the right way. You know, you had this piece you wrote on how Russia, it was an analysis of Russia using prospect theory, and the point was that among other things, they compare the status quo against whether they are going to gain or lose something, and the way they seem to approach it, or have historically approached it, is that they calculate what's going to happen from a losses point of view. And from that, you expand it into the Russian strategic view of the world, which, you know, maximize security, maximize power, and maintain great power status. Is that the core of Russian thinking, that no matter who is in charge, that those three things would be of great import to them? And can you kind of discuss, here you go, I'll give you an extended thing. Let's discuss all those, and in 25 words or less, tell us how important it is that we know about that.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I think that those things that you mentioned are really at the core of Russian worldviews and Russian foreign policy, not just sort of, you know, what Putin or, you know, his foreign policy / security team think today, but kind of in the longer term. It's maybe, you know, not necessarily that different from how other major great powers, you know, we can, I don't want to get into a discussion of, you know, is Russia a great power again or not, but you know, countries that think of themselves as great powers often look at things that way. But there is I think a lot of those three things you mentioned do get at the core of some of the fundamental worldviews of Russian leaders in foreign policy, namely that, one, Russia, you know, the idea that Russia is a great power needs to have a seat at the big, you know, the big table with, you know, the United States and China and any other, you know, maybe the EU or whatever, sort of deciding how the world works. And certainly, needs to have a larger say than, you know, some small countries that they don't think matter that much. So that's one. And because Russia was weak for much of the 90s and early 2000s, that was seen as kind of unjust, and so Russia needed to get back to its rightful place as a great power. So that's one. Two, there is that kind of, like I mentioned, the large landmass kind of aspect to it, and there is that kind of imperial syndrome, you know, the lost empire, where because Russia lost all these territories when the Soviet Union broke up, there is still some unwillingness to fully reconcile with that. And so that's where you get at the kind of territorial, you know, not territorial necessarily, but desire to have influence and to some extent control in the neighboring states. And, you know, people have called that sphere of influence. That's certainly one term for it, but there is, you know, that's where we get a lot of the conflicts in, you know, places like Ukraine and Georgia and so forth. And then the third one is the history of huge losses from past invasions, you know, particularly World War II is the one that really drives thinking. And so drives the desire to, if we're going to, you know, the kind of the thinking of, if we're going to fight, we'd rather fight on somebody else's territory rather than our own territory. So that's where there's a desire for kind of a buffer states around Russia. So those are, I think, that's way more than 25 words, but those are some of the key, I think, driving forces in Russian foreign policy.
Go ahead, Mark. You had a follow on. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say I didn't mean to limit. I was joking about the 25 words, but
I know.
Yeah, one of the points of this piece you wrote was that you thought it was unlikely that Russia would want to engage NATO over the Baltic states, and yet their stakes for Ukraine are much higher. Can you kind of explain why that's the case?
Sure. So I think that, you know, one of the factors, I mean, there's a number of different directions. We could probably take too long to go through everything, but one key aspect I'll focus on is that Russia's kind of opportunistic in this, and so and Russia does see NATO and particularly the United States as a strong, potentially too strong adversary, and doesn't really want to get involved in, you know, any kind of major conflict with NATO. So for this reason, the Baltics, you know, the leaders of the Baltics, when they were driving, you know, doing everything they could to get into NATO in, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, were actually turned out to be quite prescient in that by having the NATO security guarantee, they do protect themselves, because Russia can, I think, you know, certainly is happy to mess around with the, you know, domestic politics within those countries, and we've seen that in the past in various protests and various other incidents. They're not they don't want to do something that will result in a war with NATO and with the United States, and so the, you know, the invasion of the Baltics to, you know, driving to Riga or whatever, is they're convinced for now at least that you know, that would lead to a military response from the West, and they don't want that. Whereas Ukraine, having not gotten into NATO, and particularly at a point in time in, you know, in 2014. When it was internally divided on which direction to go in, whether to align more closely with Europe and the United States, or with Western Europe and the United States, or with Russia, turned out to be both an opportunity for Russia and also a threat of a big loss, because Ukraine, you know, of all the different countries that were part of the Soviet Union that were lost, Ukraine is the most important for both cultural ties. Ukraine is seen as much closer to Russia. There are certain, you know, the Russian state in various and you know, ways traces its origins back to Kiev 1,000 years ago, and there's also economic ties and. You know, defense industry ties, all sorts of ties. So, the potential that Ukraine, with the removal of Yanukovych, would, you know, fully join a Western alliance was potentially a huge loss, and Russia needed to take steps, or Russian leaders felt that they needed to take steps to prevent that loss. And so that was where the intervention came, and the, you know, the follow-on to that is that while Ukraine remains, you know, the bulk of Ukraine remains fairly hostile towards Russia because of those actions, Russia still wants to ensure that Ukraine does not actually join the Western alliances. And so if Ukraine starts taking further steps to go in that direction, there's the potential threat of escalation once again, because again, and then we tie back to the other thing I was talking about, which is that Russian leaders are not at all certain that, you know, say the United States would actually go and fight for Ukraine if there was some kind of conflict there, because there are, again, NATO isn't there, there aren't security guarantees and so forth.
On the subject of Ukraine, April 2014, which was like a month after they annexed Crimea, is when we had the flare up, the insurrection in eastern Ukraine. And the BBC reports, at least, these numbers vary depending upon who you talk to, of course, but they put the deaths at 13,000 since then over the 6 years. And that's flared up recently. The recent, you look at the experience that you have in the Russian government, and then, you know, Ukraine bounces back and forth, and now they have President Zelensky. How is that relationship going with Ukraine versus Russia, or are they still feeling each other out?
I think they are. I think that on the whole, there's probably the Russian leadership sees more potential for some kind of compromise with Zelensky than they did with Poroshenko, because Poroshenko had staked himself pretty strongly to an anti-Russia position. Zelensky was elected on a much more of a let's try to make peace kind of platform, and so there is at least a possibility for compromise there. At the same time, he was obviously, you know, very politically inexperienced coming in. So the Russian leadership saw that as a potential opportunity for, you know, how maybe we can take advantage of his inexperience, but also weren't sure of what he actually stood for. And so there's been kind of an extended period of initially feeling each other out and trying to make some steps towards compromise. But at the same time, you know, both sides would, I think, be interested in a compromise, but neither side is interested in a compromise that gives away too much. So in part for domestic political reasons, especially for Zelensky, this is relevant, and also for just, you know, foreign policy gains and losses. And so from that point of view, there is potential, but at the same time, you know, the most likely is that they'll keep trying to negotiate, but not actually get too far, is my guess.
One of the interesting things I find with Russia is that they seem to specialize in using ambiguity as a means of getting what they want. Is this just part of the riddle wrapped in a mystery, something in an enigma, or whatever that quote is? Or is this a time-honored Russian tradition, just be as ambiguous and as confusing as possible?
Well, I think it's more of a weapon of the weak, right? Like, Russia is just not as strong in terms of, you know, its military, its economic power, its political weight in the world as, say, the United States, and increasingly as China either. But what they are good at is having, especially compared to United States in recent years, is having very experienced foreign policy professionals who are in their jobs for a long time. And, you know, that's one advantage of an authoritarian system, is, right, these people are hanging around forever and get more and more experience in doing their jobs. And so they're much better at long-range planning and using ambiguity within that, because often they feel that that's the way they can actually get what they want, whereas, you know, a more direct approach is something that maybe the United States can get away with as, you know, as the 800-pound gorilla in international affairs, but that wouldn't work for Russia in any kind of direct manner. And we've seen a lot of successes with that, obviously the various kind of election interference situations, not just in the United States, but also in Europe for many years before that and since. But also just the way they've gotten involved in the Middle East in recent years, in Syria and then Libya and, you know, and so forth, just using proxies, using kind of agents of influence and that sort of thing. It's something that I think is effective for them because it doesn't require, you know, some of the traditional big power kind of stomping around kinds of methods that maybe they don't have, or they feel that they aren't, they wouldn't be able to compete with as well.
Because the Venn diagram isn't a perfect circle, maybe close to it, depending on how you argue it. So you always have to be careful, at least I do, thinking Russian is Soviet or Soviet is Russian, so to speak. But yesterday, we were joking about 25 words yesterday, and that clicked into my mind, 5,300 words. Yesterday was the 74th anniversary of Kenan's long telegram that he sent in 1946, where in describing the Soviet Union and developing what eventually became containment during the Cold War, he stated, quote, "The Soviet Union was impervious to the logic of reason and is highly sensitive to the logic of force," unquote. That statement kind of ties into a couple of comments we said, but how do you think maybe the long telegram in general, or at least that quote, has stood the test of time? And is it still useful when trying to understand what modern Russia is doing and thinking?
Partially, I guess. There's a big difference between Russia and the Soviet Union, and that's the lack of ideology. Right, the Soviet Union, in the end, was an ideological state. It had considerations of power and all that, and certainly, as it went along and became a superpower, that became quite prominent. But there was underlying all of that the desire to build communism in the world and expand the reach, not just of Soviet power as, for power's sake, but the reach of communism to the, and so that's where you had a lot of expansion into various countries that might not help in terms of power considerations, but were part of, this ideal of expanding communism. And Russia really doesn't have that. Russia doesn't have a real ideological goal for expanding its influence other than, the two flip sides of power, which is A, expanding Russian power, and B, limiting U.S. power, right? And so that, I think, drives, it ends up being that difference in the absence of ideology means that how you deal with the two country, with the country in different time periods, changes quite a bit, and that in the absence of ideological confrontation, it does become somewhat easier to use, I wouldn't say necessarily use reason in that, let's all, come together and we can work out our differences. I don't mean reason in that sense, but use reason in the sense of working out things to mutual advantage, or at least it's possible. Right now, we are in a period where there is a sense between the United States and Russia of heightened confrontation, where things do appear to be kind of a zero-sum game for both sides. But I don't think that's a necessary condition of the that's something that can change over time, and that was certainly something we didn't see before 2014. And it might go away. And so, there were certainly periods in the later Soviet time that there was also some ability to, as ideology became less significant in Soviet calculations, that there was also an ability to work out things to mutual advantage. I'm thinking in particular of the whole arms control agenda. And so, I think, right now we're in a period where arms control is actually being dismantled, and largely dismantled by both sides, not just by one or the other. But we can I can see conditions changing down the road where that becomes either in arms control again or in a, perhaps in economic cooperation, where now it's no longer two different economic systems fighting it out, but actually, you know, more or less the same economic system, where there comes to be areas where there where both sides see some mutual advantage in cooperation, or you know, working things out at least.
Well, one of the problems I think a lot of Americans have in grasping Russia these days is we don't know what to think of it. I mean, we know it's no longer the Soviet Union, but we don't know whether it's a thugocracy or a oligarchy or exactly, you know, is there a label that fits? You know, because what we see basically, from where I sit, sometimes is a cult of Putin, and the rest of it is, I really don't have a good grasp on it. I know when the wall first came down and things opened up, that a lot of the companies that I dealt with were really anxious to move into Russia and you know, make massive amounts of money and help them develop their economy and all that. But I'm not sure that seems to have died down quite a bit. Is there an easy label, or is there any reason to easily label where Russia is these days?
Well, I mean, it's Putin does it's not a totalitarian state in that sense, you know, like, I don't know, let's say North Korea or something, where it's everything does really revolve around one guy. Here there is more of a let's say kind of an inner circle, maybe, and certainly Putin is the arbitrator and senior and main decision maker, but he does have, you know, different interest groups within the leadership to contend with, and so you know what that means in terms of what kind of political system it is. Well, you know, it is I think. You know, the reason you don't come up with a good label on it is I'm not sure there is one, right? It is an authoritarian state, for sure, but there's certainly aspects of a kleptocracy to it, because all of the people that are in senior positions have gotten quite wealthy off, you know, skimming off the top. But at the same time, they're not stealing so much that that they're bankrupting the country, right? They're stealing, there's that old joke about, whether, you know, comparing whether, you know, two kind of dictators comparing, you know, their respective countries, and one is stealing 100% and the other is stealing 10%. Well, they're more on the 10% side. Sort of allows for continuing development, and certainly a lot of Russians, as a result, feel that they're much better off than they were under Yeltsin, for example, right? And so that is one of the factors driving Putin's popularity. Restoring Russia's position in the world is certainly another factor that's driving Putin's popularity. So it's an authoritarian regime with a certain amount of legitimacy, a reasonably high amount of legitimacy among the population, which is what allows them to, you know, keep repression relatively targeted and relatively low. If you compare it to the Soviet Union, much lower.
I know life is busy, but. The last post you did over at your Russia Mill blog post was back in November, and russiamil.wordpress.com. I'd encourage listeners to go over there for your November 12th post on Russian foreign policy narratives that I believe you're involved with the Marshall Center with support from the Russia
Yep.
Strategy Initiative. And you have a link there where they can get the full PDF version from the Marshall Center website. And as I was looking through it, I think it helps to keep in the back of your head when you're reading things from Russia. But one thing I kind of laughed about, I wanted you to flesh out a bit, because it just clicked. As like, this is exactly it. You see this. Is, you know, whataboutism is something that, you know, many people think is just a Twitter thing where somebody says, yeah, well, what about this? There's a response. But it actually is a Russian foreign policy narrative that they've been using. Talk a bit about whataboutism or and anything else with this report you think the listener would should pay attention to.
Sure. Yeah, so this is just a little bit of background. This is kind of a summary of a project we were doing for almost a year at CNA with several colleagues on, you know, tracking the narratives that Russian leaders were using when they were talking about foreign policy and relations with other states, and so just what were the key kind of, and we were doing this, you know, kind of on a biweekly basis, putting out summaries of just what were the key statements, what were they focusing on, and so the report or this particular summary report lists about, I think it was about 10 common narratives that are used, and people can, you know, go look at that and go through, you know, see all the different ones. But to focus particularly on whataboutism, this, you know, this has a long history in Russian and Soviet foreign policy going back a ways, where there's a tendency to kind of say, well, you're criticizing us for something, let's say, for our human rights record or our interventions in some foreign, some third country. But you, the United States, or you, you know, the European Union or France or whoever, do the same things or do even worse things, right? You know, and so if you go back to the Soviet period, there was a long history of Soviet media and Soviet propaganda outlets talking about, you know, racial tensions in the United States, because that was a way, and particularly the economic divide between races in the United States, because that was a way of deflecting attention from perhaps the low, you know, sort of quality of life, some of the low quality of life measures of people in the Soviet Union. And so now you have similar kinds of things where, you know, if Russia is criticized for having undemocratic elections, let's say, well, they can point to other countries, they can point to the United States and say, well, look, you guys don't do elections right either. Look at, you know, how can you criticize us when you have one candidate that I don't know, it wins the popular vote, but a different candidate becomes president, you know, or something like that. You know, you, how can you call that democratic? Or or if you criticize us for interfering in another country's internal affairs, but here's you know, your State Department officials encouraging protesters in protesting against our elections in 2012. So you guys do this. You know, we're just doing the same kinds of things as you do. And so that's kind of where a lot of the media spin comes to say, hey, we're not bad guys. We're just like you. We're doing the same kinds of things you do, and that's and so there's a common, you know, sort of trope that the Russians use in this, you know, where they talk about double standards, where, you know, you the United States officials keep criticizing us for all these things, but you guys do all this too. So, you know, what right do you have to criticize us?
We've talked a little bit about Russia and its sphere of influence, if you will, with our desire for a sphere of influence in Europe. Let's talk a little bit about Russia in the Far East, especially its relations with China and some of the other countries out there, because they are they're an Asian power, and their biggest neighbor is out there is China. So is that a strong relationship, or are they still kind of on tenterhooks as they have been in the past?
It's a relationship that's been getting stronger in over time, and particularly in recent years. Russia, it took a while for Russia to adjust to the idea that China was now becoming more powerful than Russia. You know, there was certainly long-term kind of feelings of superiority over China that they had to deal with before they could kind of have a relationship where they weren't sort of stepping on each other's toes all the time, if you were. One of the driving forces of that in recent years has been the deterioration of relations with Europe and the United States. So, if you know, it's a little bit of a triangle, right? And so Russia can't be completely isolated. So, to the extent that its partnership with, you know, let's say economic partnership in particular with some of the EU countries vanished after the various sanctions and counter-sanctions after 2014, they really had no choice but to get closer to China. And since then, the various policies that the United States and Europe have implemented to try to isolate Russia have mostly inadvertently, but have had the effect of driving them to have a closer relationship with China. And to the extent that you know, in even more recently, the U.S. and China have had a more conflictual relationship, that then encourages, you know, China's and can be in a similar position where, you know, to the extent that the Chinese-U.S. relationship is more fraught, China also looks more to Russia. As a result, what we've seen is a closer military relationship where Russia has now, in recent years, sold to China weapons that more advanced weapons that they previously didn't want to sell to China because they were concerned the Chinese would kind of reverse engineer them and then, you know, sell them as their own, which they've done in the past. But now they feel like they have no choice. They've also done a lot of joint exercises in some cases in fairly symbolic locations in the Mediterranean, in the South China Sea, to show that they're working more closely together. So this is definitely a relationship that is progressing. We saw another sign of that in, I think it was October, if I remember correctly, when Putin made an announcement that Russia was helping China develop an early warning system for ballistic missile launches. So that's something that you would expect to see from closer partners than, you know, we had thought of the Russia and China in the past. So they are, I think, moving closer together. I wouldn't call it, you know, it's not an alliance because they have some interests that converge and some that diverge, but it's maybe more, you know, sort of gradually converging on a partnership of sorts.
On the other side of the Eurasian landmass, the most obvious Russian military presence for the last few years has been in Syria, and perhaps we're approaching near the end game with the Idlib offensive, which has shown an interesting interface where the Turks have bought some Russian surface-to-air missiles that they're going to use to defend against Syrian Russian airplanes. Now they're asking for the U.S. to bring in the Patriots. It's just a big mess. But how is their experience in Syria influencing how the Russian military sees themselves and also their role in the world? Because this was a big step forward for them.
Sure. This is... really, I mean, there's a foreign policy component and a military component that are both important, right? So from the foreign policy component, they really, and it's possible we've talked about this on past in past shows, but they've really kind of inserted themselves into the Middle East in a way that's been very effective over the last 5 years. So they went from really having, for most of the post-Soviet period, having virtually no role to play in the key issues in the Middle East, whether it's Israel-Palestine or the various, you know, tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the Iraq, you know, the whole Iraq situation, to where they are now a central player, and in many cases taking a much more active role than even the United States in some of the key issues in the Middle East, you know, most of the ones I just mentioned, maybe less so the Israel-Palestine, but the other ones. And that's through a and at a relatively low cost, right? I mean, the Syria intervention was fairly small and contained, but it really kind of showed that they are a player. You know, and also the effectiveness of it in turning the conflict around and helping Assad to survive and now, you know, virtually completely consolidate control over almost all of Syria, that's really, from a foreign policy perspective, been a huge success. Now, on the military side, it's been very effective as a training ground. So you see... you know, they began when it was primarily an air operation at the beginning. They were very active in rotating crews through so that everyone would get experience flying, not just kind of doing exercises or whatever, but real operations, which they hadn't had for a long time. And since then, you know, there was also a limited ground force, air defense and so forth, and so. But you see a lot of the people who are now getting, you know, in order to get promoted within the Russian military, you really have to have at this point Syria experience, with maybe with the exception of the Navy, and you know, but within certainly in ground forces and air forces, that's been the case, and they've also used that operation to demonstrate the effectiveness of their equipment. Which has been good for arms sales. So from that point of view, it's been even lower cost because they've kind of shifted some training costs to operation costs, because instead of doing some of the exercises, those kinds of things, they've had their forces actually doing real life operations, and then they've recouped some of the costs with arms sales as well. So it's been. You know, from the Russian point of view, it's been a big success all around.
Of the former client states of the Soviet Union, I mean, they still have some strong ties with say Vietnam, and they have some other interests in the other Southeast Asian countries where they're trying to work with the. ASEAN and all those other organizations. How much of that? I mean, North. I mean, Vietnam is one of the countries bumping up against China's expansionist interest in the South China Sea, for example. You know, are these possible areas of friction with Russia? Is Russia just, you know, I want to go back to this relationship with China a bit more because, you know, the Russians have kind of opened up the Arctic to allow to pump gas down to China, and China's got a major interest in some of those plants up there. Is it just still a wheel that's in spin, and there are going to be these various interest areas that may bump up against each other every now and then, like South China Sea?
Sure. Yeah, so for a long time, Russia, one of the reasons that Russia was really studiously trying to be neutral on some of the disputes in that region, you know, the territorial disputes between, say, you know, China and Vietnam and a whole bunch of other countries, was because they wanted to develop these relationships with these Southeast Asian countries. And what we've seen in recent years is that they've kind of inched a little bit more towards the Chinese side, and that goes back to that dependence on China that I was talking about earlier. It hasn't gone so far that they are, you know, no longer able to develop those other relationships, so that's still in place. But the bulk of those relations has really been in two areas. One is arms sales, and the other is energy. So, which includes, you know, we often think of Russia, okay, you know, oil, natural gas exporter. But the other thing that they export a lot is nuclear power plant know-how. So they're out there building nuclear power plants for a whole bunch of countries. I can't off the top of my head remember which of the Southeast Asian ones that includes, but I know there are some that they've worked on in those areas, as well as, you know, the more traditional kind of helping in oil and gas exploration and that sort of thing. But it's a relationship. Those are relationships are more economic, you know, just pure kind of economic transactional kind of relationships. So these kind of arms sales and other economic transactions, rather than any kind of a deeper strategic partnership kind of thing like they're trying to develop with China.
One of the things I did when we were doing a little bit of show prep here is one of my little hobbies is demographics, and everybody remembers at the fall of the Soviet Union there was just a huge demographic nightmare. And you know, what we've noticed in the last few years is after bottoming out about 2000, when you look at number of births per women, it was down to 1.2. Russia has recently increased up to 1.75 per female, and the USA had replacement rate, which is 2.1 back in 2008, but we've gone down to 1.8, just 0.05 above Russia. And of course, Russia's birth rate is above China, Germany, Iran, and you know, the future belongs to those that show up. And with the way trends are going, if they can stabilize their population, and that many times can translate some economic benefits. We've even seen the Russian life expectancy. It peaked in, no shock here, at 69.46 in 1988, right before the Soviet Union imploded. But after cratering a bit, it's come back up to 71.59. Respectable increases. Is that type of looking at numbers and optimism about the future, is that something internally or externally is part of the conversation now, where people may have assumptions based upon the late 90s, early 2000s about the demographics of Russia?
That's funny that, you know, I'm used to getting this question from pessimists, right, who are like, pessimists from, you know, people who think, Russian – you know, let's look. You know, look at the numbers. Russian population is going to collapse, right? So it's nice to hear it from the other side. I think that because I usually end up having to counter the pessimist. It's a complex picture. There is certainly there are you know, when you look at it in a comparative sense, as you did. Russia is, I think, comparable to a lot of these other industrialized, you know, developed countries like the United States, like European countries, and so forth. And so we should see similar trends. The one difference is that Russia still has a relatively high, you know, again, comparatively speaking, mortality rate among men, and especially among men of sort of prime working age. And that's, you know, there's various, you know, whether that is tied to alcohol or various other, you know, at higher rates of accidents, which may also be tied to alcohol. But there is this loss of, and there's a fairly large gap between men and women in terms of life expectancy. But there's this loss of men in kind of prime productive years that doesn't, it doesn't exist in, you know, most of the other countries that you and I have mentioned. So that is a problem for Russia. It's not a big problem. It's not, you know, it's not something that's going to drive, you know, the Russians aren't going to disappear or anything. But it is something that they are concerned about. And, you know, if you listen to Vladimir Putin whenever he talks about these kinds of issues, he's always talking, you know, he's talking about we need more, you know, better health care, you know, improve some of these mortality statistics. He also talks about higher birth rates as well. But that, you know, that's all part of that scene, that there is a sense among the Russian leaders that they need to do even more to improve their demographics. But from an analytical position, it's kind of not that different from the rest of the world.
Well, Dmitry, we've taken up another hour of your valuable time. And before we let you go, though, I want to ask if there's something we should be looking forward to seeing from you in the future. And before you start answering that question, thanks again for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me. This is great, as always. And as far as what's coming out next, I am finishing up another, you know, one of these policy briefs for through the Marshall Center. This one's going to look at who have been the influential players in the Russian political elite over the last 20 years. So I found some data that I won't go into now, but basically just tracking who have been the key players and some of the patterns there. So that I'm hoping that'll be out in the next month or so. I'm also doing some work on the Russia-China relationship that we've just, you know, we were just discussing, and I should be something on that maybe a little bit later than that, but also in the next couple of months. And then in a slightly longer term, I'm starting a project on looking at where Russian private military companies have fit into the overall kind of Russian influence game, particularly in Africa. So that's something just getting underway. So probably later, and, you know, towards the end of 2020, probably see something on that.
Well, you will probably own the territory at that last item. I was thinking of a couple of guys I know who look at Africa, who would definitely find the Russian private military companies in Africa to be an interesting topic. I look forward to seeing it. And just to join with my co-host, it's always a pleasure, Dmitry. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks for having me. We'll probably talk again in a year or two.
Yes, sir.
Right? We seem to have a pattern.
we'll book you right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, have a great springtime, Dmitry.
Thanks, you too. Take care.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Rats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.